It's my pleasure to introduce the last speaker of the day, Andy Gonzalez. I have to restrain myself from commenting on his bio because we have a friendly banter all the time, but I'll try to be professional about this, not take advantage of the opportunity. He obtained his PhD in biology from Imperial College London in 1998. He then spent a number of months, 6 months, as a postdoctoral researcher at Université de Paris before accepting an assistant professor position there. But in September 2003, he moved to McGill, where he is a Canada Research Chair in Biodiversity in the Department of Biology, and he's also, as I mentioned, the director and founder of the Quebec Center of Biodiversity Science. His research is focused on the causes and consequences of biodiversity loss. And from an applied point of view, it's also aimed at applying science to mitigate the causes of extinction. His research team conducts experiments in a variety of ways. In the field and the lab, they use theory and databases to tackle various projects related to biodiversity loss, including the impacts of habitat fragmentation, species persistence in changing environments, the role of evolutionary rescue, and also the impacts of economic activity and biodiversity. You can see he's very broad in his interests and very creative and a fantastic colleague, and we're glad to have him.
Thank you, Tony. That was a very generous introduction. I wasn't expecting that. I'm happy to have it, though. And what a great day of talks we've had. We've seen an incredible range of questions and approaches and how ecological science can help us better understand what's going on in the Anthropocene. And we've seen a lot about how to estimate impacts, how to evaluate the degree of predictability that we might have, some of the limits of our knowledge and how we might be able to address those limits to improve predictions over the coming century. Today I'm going to tackle the problem of providing solutions. How do we go from evaluating and understanding to providing solutions based on science? And for me, I'm going to give you a very personal story from a place of fairly deep certainty about my understanding of the ecological world through the lens of community ecology and biodiversity science to a place of deep vulnerability and rabbit caught in the headlights kind of scenario when I was asked to provide a solution or a design for the Green Belt of Montreal that was based on ecological science, on biodiversity science. Pretty scary, and you'll see how this unfolds hopefully in the next 25 minutes. So if there's one word that captures the Anthropocene, I would say it's connectivity. As during the great acceleration that we've seen this morning during the video, it's clear that humans are more deeply connected to the physical environment and to the biosphere. To the extent that we extract resources and appropriate solar energy and modify the functions and the cycles of ecosystems, we are more deeply connected to that biosphere than we ever have been, which is why we're driving it. But that embedding in the biosphere has allowed us to improve our own connectivity, right? I'm talking about economic connectivity and trade, information and exchange of information via things like smartphones and internet and social media. All those things mean that we're now in a global village, right, where we are in a highly connected world, both with each other and with the biosphere. So it's one of the abiding ironies, I think, that we are at the same time greatly disconnecting the biosphere. If we take the example of global forest change, we are heavily fragmenting and transforming forest cover. This is happening now at a rate that's faster than at any other time since the last ice age. A recent statistic shows that 70% of the world's forests are within 1 kilometer of an edge. 70% of the world's forests are within 1 kilometer of an edge. So the idea of fragmentation, of forest fragmentation, has never been more relevant. And so as we increasingly connect our world, our economy, and our cultures, we're increasingly disconnecting our physical and terrestrial landscapes. So I want to show you very quickly a video from the kind of data that is arising from the initiatives of Google, the advent of remote sensing and satellite data. What I'm going to show you here is just a picture for North America of essentially real-time forest loss. So you're going to see patches of red. Those patches of red are where forest has been lost and eroded and fragmented over the last decade. So you can see we're zooming in. The yellow are the hot spots of urban centers. There you can see, hopefully you can see the red in the north and of Canada, in the south and east of the US, north of Quebec. You can see that there are, the last decade has been an incredibly influential period in forest change. And what this video is trying to show is that, yes, it's a global phenomenon, but it's happening regionally. That it affects us as human beings, as society, at the regional scale. And that forest loss and ecosystem change due to human land use change is a pan-regional process. We have to study this at the regional scale and consider regions as replicate blocks of interactions between society and the biosphere. So, and it's of course at the regional scale that the fragmentation becomes most apparent. We can zoom in at that highest level and see for our particular region here, this is the city of Montreal. We are sat right here, right now. You can see that this region has been massively transformed for agriculture and for urban development. We've cleared vast regions of the St. Lawrence lowlands to grow crops and to feed people and to feed pigs and to maintain our society. But clearly this is a region that has been heavily transformed. And what I was asked to do was to provide a new vision or a new thinking about how we might restore and conserve and maintain biodiversity. And to do that, we need to focus on, I was asked to focus on fragmentation. So fragmentation, sort of 101 ecology, this is the kind of figure you'll see in a textbook on fragmentation. Habitat loss leads to many, many negative consequences. Habitat loss leads to loss of total area of your cover. So we may go from a large contiguous area to a smaller block of area over a relatively short period of time. But there are a suite of other things that go with the process of habitat loss. The first of these might be an increased number of small habitat fragments. As we pixelate the landscape, as we do that, fragment size reduces and we get increased edge to interior ratio so that more of the landscape can be considered to be edge. And finally, fragments become increasingly isolated from each other so that we have islands of forest, if you like, interspersed by agricultural urban land cover. And the critical question of my research over the last 15 years has been trying to demonstrate the influence of fragmentation per se. I think that the question of, I'm not going to get this thing to come up, but if we compare these two cases, right? Surface area is identical in both cases. What are the ecological consequences of dispersing your habitat in this fragmented way versus in this way? And the jury, surprisingly or not, is still out, at least for many people in the literature, people aren't entirely convinced that we should be worrying about fragmentation. To first approximation, we should only really worry about how much habitat is lost. And I would argue that the jury should no longer be out, that we know that connectivity matters. We can demonstrate that theoretically, we can demonstrate it experimentally, and we can do vast surveys that also demonstrate the result. So here is a smattering of, a highly biased smattering of the literature related to things that I've been thinking about over the last 15 years, where I think connectivity is essential. So connectivity mediates the stability and the trophic complexity of ecological communities at local and regional scales. Altering connectivity and optimally adjusting connectivity can maintain ecosystem function as well, not just the numbers of species or the distribution of species. Connectivity increases the probability of evolutionary adaptation, rapid evolutionary rescue. We can show that experimentally and theoretically. And connectivity can mediate, as Patrick nicely showed us just now, the rate and the predictability of range shifts. Now, you can drill into the literature in each of these cases and build up quite a strong case that connectivity matters. And most recently, we're able to show that if you work towards a general unified theory of biodiversity where we're trying to explain the diversity, this trophic structure and the distribution of diversity in landscapes of varying degrees of connectivity, we can show that the complexity of a trophic web in any given patch or in any given region of patches depends upon two things. Depends upon the spatial scale of dispersal and depends on the rate of colonization of species within that system. And if you tune those two parameters, just those two parameters, you can create arbitrarily complex communities, and that complexity tends to peak at intermediate rates of colonization rate and dispersal scale. Of course, it's a model. We've simplified many things. But what's very satisfying is that even if you only focus on one parameter, that connectivity parameter, you can explain a lot of processes and a lot of features of local communities and the regions within which they are embedded. So it was that, with that background, that I was asked to think about how we might design an ecological network for biodiversity for a city of 3.5 million people that has a huge impact on the hinterland surrounding it. It was a remarkable day. I remember exactly when I got this phone call. It was about 9:30 in the morning on September 12, 2007. I got a call from the Ministry of Environment in Quebec City. And a gentleman said to me, "Oh, I've been looking at your webpage, and I realize you think a lot about connectivity and corridors and networks. Can you help us, the Quebec government, design a network of corridors and habitat for this region?" And I said, "Well, sure, just give me 10 minutes and I'll have that recipe for you." But of course, my brain started spinning. Not only was I'm not sure whether I was like a rabbit caught in the headlights of an oncoming truck, or whether I was really just like an opossum that just wanted to roll over and pretend I was dead, but I just was thinking, I'm not ready for this. I can't give you an answer. I can't design an ecological network for a city of 5 million people. I can't do it. And then I thought to myself, well, if I can't do it, who's going to do it? I mean, at what point do we put the rubber to the road and do we decide to apply the science that we've been developing for the last 2 to 3 decades to actually provide a solution to decision makers? And so I decided to do it. It was incredibly scary and a very vulnerable place to be because you're going to be wrong, and people might get mad at you for being wrong, but I decided it was better to be wrong and to offer a solution and something to be shot at than to not do anything at all. So what I'm going to tell you about now is that story about how we tried to come together, and this is the work of postdocs and graduate students, some of whom are in this room, as we built up the knowledge needed to do this job. So this is the same region viewed only through the mask of what forest is available. And you can see it's a highly fragmented region of forest. There's a central band, which is highly sort of an ecological zone around the region, which has been heavily transformed for agriculture. But then, of course, we have the townships and the Appalachians here and the Laurentian Mountains to the north. There are two key things about this region, apart from the fact that it's highly fragmented, is that the distribution of fragments in this region, if you look at the size distribution, so this is the size distribution in hectares of fragments, you see that 70% of all fragments in this region are smaller than 20 hectares. So we're dealing with a landscape that's full of small fragments. We can't just say, you know what, we'll just take care of the big stuff. We can't do that. We have to also figure out the contribution of the small fragments. And so that's the power of the network perspective, is that you can take into account and try to evaluate the contribution of even the smallest fragment. We have to deal with that because that's the population of fragments that we have available. So from a connectivity point of view, how do you answer the question, how important is that fragment? Ask yourself that question. Is it, as Jehon was saying earlier on, is it based on the number of dollars that this thing contributes in terms of carbon sequestered and stored? Is it based on the amount of maple syrup it produces? Is it based on the number of bumblebees that are nesting in that landscape that are pollinating apple orchards some kilometers away? Of course, the answer is all of these things. And we have to make an evaluation that's based on the sum of all those contributions. And from my perspective, I wanted to know how the proximity of fragments to each other, their isolatedness, their connectedness, was contributing to their value. So we needed a theoretical framework and a formal framework that incorporated what we know about connectivity into a very pragmatic model of how to evaluate the importance of a given fragment. And so there were three criteria that I was most interested in, and I think the government were interested in, but I sort of forced them to think about it this way. So I wanted to make sure that this first of all, that this network of forest was traversable. Right, this area is highly disconnected. It's very hard for species to move from the south of the northern states of the U.S. into the Laurentians because there's a roadblock. There's a massive great big freshwater ecosystem and a highly fragmented forest system. So that was the first point. The second thing is that this system has to be connected. It has to be self maintaining. It has to maintain local biodiversity, regional biodiversity, and regional ecosystem processes. And finally, I think from a human point of view, it has to be controllable, whatever that means. We have to be able to steer the landscape through a series of future scenarios that are desirable, given oncoming climate change and human population growth in the region. So the idea of controllable is actually a technical term in engineering. Is the idea is that you can tune a network so that you can take it into a set of desired states. And so that's my ultimate fantasy for this research. And of course, the idea is to be able to identify some fragments, to be able to prioritize some fragments as more important than others. Can we do that? Can we actually rank every fragment from the smallest 1 hectare fragment up to the largest 1,000 hectare fragments in terms of their contribution to biodiversity in the region, to that network of biodiversity, and the contribution of those fragments to ecosystem services? And not to do it for one species at a time. Right, normally we think about this from the point of view of a flagship species or an umbrella species or a keystone species because we're daunted by the great diversity of natural systems, whether they are invertebrates or vertebrates, amphibians or reptiles. We have to design a landscape. If we're going to do this and rise to the challenge, we have to design it for the perspective of every species. Because every species has its own spatial network of habitat that it needs. Every species has a breeding site or ground or range, has a natal range, moves around its landscape to acquire resources, food, mates, what have you. And so we have to think about the problem of it's a multidimensional network problem. We have to optimize the design of our landscape based on the needs of many, many species and their networks. So we refused to take this sort of single species, flagship, umbrella species approach. We decided to reduce the dimensionality of the biodiversity in this region into two axes. Essentially, we wanted to fill this region. We wanted to take species at the extremes of these axes of lifespan versus offspring and body size. And we figured if we can design our landscape or our network within this sphere, then many other species should be able to find their way within that space. We can come back to whether that's useful, whether it's going to work or not, but it's a different take on the standard approach. And so we explore the landscape from the point of view of the extremes of this multivariate space. So we selected our species, and right now we're working on 13 species. I'm only going to show you results from 5 today. And here is our framework. So we have to take a set of species. We want to make our network resilient to climate change. So there's no point investing in a network today that's not going to work in 100 years from now. Right? It's like our bridges in this city. Right? It's like building a bridge in 1916 doesn't work in 2000. We have to take into the fact this thing is going to erode and there's going to be climate change. So we modeled climate change and the response of every species to climate change. Then we have another model that also takes into account land use change. And so we try to project simultaneously climate change and land use change, and we predict the responses, the spatio-temporal response of every species that we take into account through time. And then based on that shift in the distribution and the quality of habitat, we evaluate the connectedness of that region for each species. Okay? And once we've created that network, we can look to see how that network is reconfigured by ongoing land use change or ongoing climate change or the two together, scenario after scenario. We can consider a worst-case scenario from an IPCC 4 degrees Celsius or a mid-range scenario 2.5 degrees. And we can consider a worst-case scenario of land use change versus a business-as-usual scenario of land use change. So that's the power of that. And, of course, once we've designed our network, we can feed it back into the machine, right, and ask how resilient is that network to future iterations. Of course, I don't have the time to show you the inner workings of all of this, but I just want to show you one result that's arising from our land use change model. So this is the work of Cécile Albert, who's refining this model. It's not perfect, but it's doing a pretty good job based on fitting it with past historical changes. But this is our land use model on what for today. Actually, technically, it's for the year 2000. And what you can see is that we've simplified land cover change to 3 categories, forest, agriculture, and urban. We could add another 17 classes if we wanted to, but there's no point for the sake of the message that I want to show you. So here is today. This is what it's going to look like in 2050 under a business-as-usual scenario. And again, and again, and one more time. I'm hoping that you're seeing that it's not, that green is being eroded, that urban is spreading to the north and to the west. That's incredibly true. That's exactly what's happening. And that we have an incredibly or increasingly fragmented region. So we can use that prediction, and we can iterate it over many time steps, of course, to understand the future appropriateness or fit of this landscape to the needs of the many species we're modeling. And so we can categorize the responses of all the biodiversity in this region to the future. And we take into account, we can look at different scenarios. We can look at the case with only climate changing, land use changing, climate and land use changing for one scenario, climate and changing for another scenario. All right, so we can look at the interactions and the synergies between these different drivers. So here is time out to 2050. Here is habitat quality for the white-tailed deer or the red-backed salamander. You can see in both cases the response is the same. Okay, climate has absolutely no effect on these species at the scale of our region. But you throw in an interaction with climate change and land use change, and the world starts getting a bit less prettier for these two species, that things are starting to erode, and the quality of the habitat in this region is starting to erode. And we can map this for these two species, of course, so for the present and the future. For these two cases, you can't see it from 10 meters away, but there are differences in the proportion of useful habitat. But there are other cases where some species are going to improve. The quality of the habitat for this region for the sugar maple is actually going to improve. You see the northwest limit of this region is not so good for the sugar maple, but in 2015 it's going to do better. Okay? So that under this case of climate change, we see an improved region, an improved outcome. But if you start looking at synergies between these two drivers, even the sugar maple is not going to do so well. And if you now look at the case of the paper birch, now you can see the synergies are terrible. Right? The species is going from happy to rather unhappy in terms of its spatial distribution and habitat quality. And then for the sycamore, you can see a case where we have it's excluded from this region, and this region will become habitable for this species over the coming century. I'm not going into any of the dynamics of this, the demography of this. Of course, we're extracting away all that horrible detail. But now we have a map of the quality of habitat fragment by fragment for all species. Now we can start building the network. Now we can start identifying the connectivity of this space. So here's a slice of our region. Some of you will recognize the Monteregion Hills here, Mont-Saint-Hilaire, Yamaska, Rougemont, Saint-Bruno, and this is Sorel here. And the colors are meaningless. The colors are just there for show. imagine this. So biodiversity, Jonathan gave us a very important message earlier on. How we perceive biodiversity depends on a question of scale. That's true for us, but it's also true for species. Species perceive the same landscape very differently depending upon whether they are a bumblebee, American martin, or a white-tailed deer, or an ovenbird. All right? And so we have to take into account the species dimensions of how it perceives that landscape. So we have to take into account that each patch is potentially a node. And as they move between patches, we identify a link. And that allows us to assemble and identify the network for our species based on their body size and their habitat needs. Okay? And so what I did there is I walked you through different body size species and how they perceive the connectivity of that landscape. When we do that at the scale of our region, 100 by 100 kilometers, we build these things. So this is each one of these is a map of the network of each of the of three species, the white-tailed deer, the American martin, and the ovenbird. Okay, so you can see that it looks like a spider's web, right? There are some zones of the spider's web that are pretty low in connectivity and others that are very highly reticulate and highly interconnected. You'll notice there's a hole here for the city of Montreal, but there are other holes in the landscape that are not explained necessarily by the absence of forest, but because of the discontinuities in the landscape and the cost of moving in the matrix. That's for the American martin, an even sparser network. It's hard for the American martin to make a living in this landscape as it fragments. And then the ovenbird, which is a much more interconnected landscape and does rather better. So once we've assembled these networks for every species, then we can begin to look at the properties of this system. All right? We can imagine flowing organisms along this landscape. We can look at the dynamical robustness of these networks. So here is an example of how the conductance of these species networks. How easy is it for an individual to move through the landscape from south to north? So for here we have four species, the common bumblebee, the American martin, the white-tailed deer, and the red-back salamander. If it's blue, it's bad. If it's blue, there's a high resistance, and our species has trouble moving. Individuals of our species have trouble moving in that landscape. If it's yellow, that's a pinch point. That's a funnel by which lots of individuals go through. And if it's red, it's okay. It's a sort of intermediate level of connectivity. So you see, from the perspective of each species, there's quite a different heat map of connectivity in our landscape. And we have to take that into account. But conductance is not the only thing we have to take into account. Because connectivity is a multidimensional notion. It's not just about how easy it is for an individual to move, but connectivity is also about metapopulation capacity. It's also about how each patch contributes to the overall demography of the system. Right? So some patches are more important for metapopulation capacity of each species than others. Some measures are centrality. So centrality is like a measure of betweenness. How often a single patch is traversed within the landscape. It's sort of this sort of this keystone the patch in the system. And the centrality of for a given species, patches of high centrality are not necessarily the patches that have high metapopulation capacity. So it's a multidimensional measure. We take into account other factors, and then we have to solve this multidimensional optimization problem. We have four criteria here, but there are others. Remember, we have a criteria for climate. Have one of these maps for every scenario of climate change and land use change multiplied by as many species as there are. It's a hard problem. Fortunately, there are algorithms that can deal with that. You can get very sophisticated and deep into these algorithms, but this particular algorithm is quite simple and powerful, and is due to the work of Atom Moilanen and his software Zonation. Essentially, to boil down quite a complicated process, what happens is you have some value for the network, the overall quantitative value of it for each thing. You delete a patch. The computer deletes a patch, and it calculates the change in the value when you delete that patch. And you do that systematically for every patch, all 40,000, say, if you're a bumblebee, or 10,000 if you're a white-tailed deer. And you can calculate the delta, or the change in the properties of that network, based on each of your criteria. And then once you've done that, you have a ranking of all the patches, and then you can take the best-case additive benefit function, you sum all the contributions of all those patches, and that gives you a final map of which patches are the most important for the N species for that given scenario. That's the best intuition I can give you in 10 seconds. So, drum roll, this is the first map we produced for today, essentially. It's 2000, that shows you a ranking of every fragment of at least 30 by 30 meters in our region. So, dark green means very, very good. Okay, high ranking. Those patches are essential to the connectivity of the region. Dark red means lousy connectivity, not so good, and in between the greens and the lime greens, intermediate levels. So hopefully you'll notice several things. Firstly, that the agricultural region is essentially red, that the contiguous forests to the south and north are green, but there are key stepping stones or areas of high connectivity that pass to the north and the east of the city that are of extreme importance for the overall network, for these N species for today. Okay? Hopefully, if you squint, you can also see that there is a band of yellow or lime green to the north. So that means that the matrix is relatively high connectivity in addition to these stepping stones. So what this is beginning to show is that there is a highway of connectivity to the north of the city. Land use change. 2050, what does this landscape look like? Well, here is the difference between today and 2050 if we do nothing else. Hopefully you'll notice that there's a massive simplification of the landscape. We've lost a lot of dark green and we have a much more fragmented region. Fortunately, under climate change, in general climate change, business as usual, you'll see that not only have we lost key fragments, but also the band to this region here is wider. And that's to do with the ongoing estimates of movement for different species under scenarios of fragmentation and interpatch distances changing. So the last scenario I want to show you is under climate change. Let's add business as usual and climate change. What's the difference? You'll notice that we've broadened, there's a broader region here of traversability. So actually climate change is going to ameliorate the region from the point of view of most species in terms of the connectivity of the matrix. Even if there are fewer key patches in the overall network, climate change is probably going to improve the overall connectivity, at least of the matrix. So my penultimate slide, I'm incredibly excited about these. Obviously, these are the first maps, and we designed maps so that they were going to be useful for stakeholders. We want stakeholders to be able to take a map and be able to make a decision, to be able to zoom in to their fragment, to their backyard, and decide what's the contribution of my fragment or my forest lot to the overall connectivity of the region. And so I was fiddling the other day, and we're trying to get ourselves to a tool where someone can download from our web page the prioritization map, add it to Google Earth, and begin to contextualize the network, the regional network within our region, and to zoom in and be able to locate based on their municipality, their city, their region, whatever it is, if they're an NGO, their sector, how to understand the contributions of their particular habitats and their particular fragments to the overall whole. And so what this gives us is a regional plan. For the first time, we have a connectivity criterion that can help us design an entire region for biodiversity and ecosystem services. And this is important because up until now, there are many, many corridor projects in the region. Each one tends to focus on a small part of our region. It's incredibly important work, but each person is working, each municipality, each NGO is working in their corner, and they haven't been talking to each other. And so what we have now is a baseline for discourse. And so I want to now go out into that region and start meeting. I have been doing a lot of talks, trying to convey the solution to people to help them begin to project what they're going to do in their landscape over the coming decade. And finally, earlier on, Jérôme alluded to Montreal Greenbelt. And our hope, and Jérôme is going to join my lab to sort of fold in the ecosystem services valuation dimension of that into our network identification. And so our plan is to move away from thinking about the green belt as a great big donut we put around a city, but rather as something much more integrative that connects the green infrastructure with the gray infrastructure of our city at a time when we most need to do that as we redesign our green-gray infrastructure, our bridges and our roads and our energy and power networks, so that they are more considerate, more harmonious with the ecological networks of the region. And so with that, a little plug for a concert at the Bell Center that Jérôme and friends are organizing. 15,000 people are going to go and listen to Jérôme play. We have some comedians. What's the point of this concert? Every person who buys a ticket will plant a tree, meaning their ticket will pay for a tree. If you pay $15, they'll plant one tree. If you pay $55, potentially five. And so this is how we're going to go from the theory, from the maps, hopefully into action. And the goal is to be able to plant 375,000 trees in time for the 375th birthday of anniversary of the City of Montreal. So that sums up the journey that I've gone on from assurance, safety in my knowledge of what biodiversity science is, to the position of having a vulnerability and having to provide a solution. It's been an incredible journey, and it's something I never want to stop. And I think our science is mature enough right now to begin to do this. We have to do it. This is the community that has to provide solutions to stakeholders and to society. So this is just one option, one way that we can go about this. Thank you very much.
Andy, do we have any questions?
Joyce.
So, Andy, the one component you didn't talk about, and maybe it's in your models, is the abiotic component. So the influence of soil, soil moisture, soils themselves. Do you take that into account in any of this, and what influences or effects do you see?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the climate, I didn't show any of the details of the climate scenarios. They are, we get a lot of variables that come from Uranus. Some of them are precipitation and temperature and snowfall. We collapse all that into a reduced subset in multivariate space. So we capture, it's much more than temperature. For soils, we take into account the baseline data that we have on the productivity from the forest point of view, and we know there's great heterogeneity in the soil qualities. Soil is not one of the criteria we optimize for. So we don't say, okay, we'll keep this sector because this is productive soil. But it could be. The point is that this is a very general approach that allows us to add any layer that you want. But it's very important if we want to start planting trees, if we want, you know, to maximize carbon storage. You know, we want highly productive forests. Beth. Five questions.
I really love the idea of putting your map on top of Google Earth and having that to be an interactive thing with people who maybe own land. It's awesome. What I would wonder is if someone looks at their farm where they happen to have a few patches and it's in the red zone where it seems unimportant for connectivity, will that decrease? I mean, I don't know if in your conversations with farmers you've come across this, will that like decrease their desire to maybe maintain that patch because it's red and not important?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So there are two points. First of all, it's relative. The value is relative between 0 and 1. So it does, if it's 0, it doesn't mean it has absolute no contribution. It has some contribution, but it's relative to the others. But that doesn't help. That's a difficult concept to explain to a typical landowner. No, it's okay. Your forest is relatively good. But what we can do is we walk through the steps of how to switch it from red to yellow to green. And that's very, very easy. And I don't show you the sensitivity of the model today. I just don't have the time. But you can begin to use it to proactively manage and change. So if I connect it, or if I increase the area, or if I change the matrix, in particular the matrix, you can begin to modify, and somebody can then feel part of the solution, not just being part of the problem. And that's the goal of the tool, is to say, okay, I'm going to project your woodlot into the future. How can I improve its contribution to the landscape? Rina.
Yeah, super interesting project, Andy. And
thank
yeah, thanks for spearheading it. It really looks like it's going to be a very useful tool. I was sort of struck when you presented the future scenarios of land use in 2050, how connected the urban areas were growing. And yeah, maybe there's something to be learned there by, you know, as we are able to clearly connect our urban areas, maybe what is it about our behavior that allows us to connect urban areas that we couldn't then use that to connect the more natural spaces?
That's a great question. That's a beer conversation. So actually the model, so we have behind the model predicts spread of all the different land classes, and there's a very strong propensity for urban areas to become more urban areas, and it's predicted by roads. Surprise, surprise. And so the economic rules that allow spread of urban areas, settlement, shopping malls, are highly spatially autocorrelated, and that's quite a simple thing to predict, and we can validate that. But the rules that apply for urban systems and economic systems are not exactly the same that allow us to predict the ecological connectivity. So then what your question leads to is, how do we make that more synergistic, right? So how do we make the process of spread of urban systems more considerate of the underlying system? And so then we have to co-design landscapes with land use managers, land planners, architects. So that's where this is going. And anyone who's watched TED Talks who knows that this is what, you know, this eco-cities in the future, they're trying to do that, but they lack the deep ecological science that's needed to do that, that in a way that, you know, we think we understand biodiversity and ecosystems work. But that's the key for the future.
Yeah, great talk. That seems like a very interesting project. I was wondering if you have included phenotypic variation from those species into your model, because we had a few talks that argued that could be quite an important phenomenon, and you think that at this scale it's important to include this information, and could this change any of your prediction?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
It's hard to get up in the morning when you start to list the things that are not captured by this model. But you know what? The UK famously has a micro model for its economy. It tries to predict the future of the British economy, and it's no better than the flick of a coin. So that I sort of get up in the morning based on that, thinking, well, I can do better than a flip of a coin. But really, you're quite right. That's not a good excuse not to use the British microeconomic model as a goalpost. So yes, we can build in intra-specific variation. But there's nothing in the system that doesn't allow us to do that. Basically, we have a single value for quality, but we can make that a distribution of qualities. We have a single value for movement. Actually, that's not true. Now we take into account different types of movement. So we take into account daily movements and natal movements. So actually, that answers a bit of your question. So on the life history trait that matters most from the point of view of the model, we're building in within life cycle variation and dispersal ability. Does that get us to sort of the evolutionary dynamics that Andrew alluded to, or the trophic complexities that Dominique was talking about? Not yet. We don't even model competition yet in the way that Patrick was doing it, but that's not a limit. Actually, Patrick and I are talking about how to meld his model to this spatial network. It's coming. I would say this is sort of phase two and three of the model. Now we have the framework, we can build in some of the gory details.
And that's part of the problem here. You're sort of starting with that premise. But there are many scenarios where there's a nuance. And the example that I got thinking about with your deer, at least where I'm from, deer can actually be quite a nuisance to many plants. And the coexistence of some rare orchid might not want those deer to be very well connected in order for them to have their own release. And I know that's annoying, but how do you, I mean, it sounds like maybe you can deal with some of these interactions by filling them in.
Yep.
But then you deal with a little bit of a sort of valuation of which species is more.
So that's a great question. I don't build in any value. I say, what does it take for this organism to move around the system? And what's its capacity for the white-tailed deer? Then if you wanted to tune the solution to eradicate the white-tailed deer, right, you take that the white-tailed deer network and you say, I want to cut its capacity by 50%. Let's say we explore that between you and I over a beer tonight. All right? What would it do to the optimal solution to tune away the importance of the white-tailed deer because it's a crazy herbivore, because it's a host for Lyme disease, you know, and it does all other stuff? You could do that. But then there's somebody else who say, well, no, actually, I quite like hunting the white-tailed deer. Right? And so now you're dealing with human valuation problems. And that's where you step away from the ecological science and you go into sort of the social sciences and the economic sciences. And all of this will be useless if I don't have that dialogue, if our team doesn't have that dialogue. And we're doing it. And part of that through Jerome is going to help us get to at least the economic dimension. But we are working with stakeholders. We have these big stakeholder meetings where they say, no, we're interested in this particular thing or this particular species. I have students in my lab working on Lyme disease. Right, and they are figuring out that the white-footed mouse and other small mammals are a pain in the neck. We have a model for the white-footed mouse. If you want to be able to control a network, then you need other concepts like modularity. Can you isolate parts of the network to control invasive species spread? We've thought about that, and so can you make parts of the region more controllable by having modules of spatial connectivity that you can then go in and target? It's fantasy right now. It's science fiction, but we have to try.
Considering the fact that the Quebec government in general is motivated more by rural than urban concerns, it seems to me that we need a series of alternate maps dealing with the various possibilities so that we can choose the lesser of all the evils, because otherwise you're seeming to be working on the assumption that since this map that you've come up with represents a model of what would be the sort of the best course of action that is going to necessarily be followed, which I think is questionable from a political point of view. So the question is there a possibility of having a series of maps with various alternative possibilities so that one can choose between that which is more or less important?
That's exactly what we do. So we sit down with stakeholders, we show them a small subset of maps like I did today. I can generate 144 maps for you if you want. It's the number of species times the number of climate change scenarios times the number of land use change scenarios. I didn't want to show you all those. I showed you a smattering of those. But there is no limit to that. And so if, as a collective, as a society, we decide we want to know solutions for this trajectory of the future, these are the maps that we want to see. And then you iterate that cycle with the stakeholders, with the people, to decide, okay, this is our best case of what business as usual plus 2.5 degrees Celsius looks like. Let's make decisions in this subset of the future. Bearing in mind that obviously this is one set of criteria. It's an ecological set of criteria based on connectivity. You could raise doubt about that. But I would argue that those ecological criteria have to be at the table just as much as the economic and the social and the cultural. So, yes, we can do that. It's very easy. We're doing it.
Thank you very much, Andy. The diversity of presentations we've seen today, I think, have given us a glimpse of the depth and breadth of the complexity of issues that scientists and managers have to deal with. It's in the Anthropocene, it's an interesting time to be a natural scientist. It's perhaps a frightening time to be an environmentalist. It's an exciting time to be a student. Thank you all for your participation today.